Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick.
Article 1 is adopted.
One thing that everybody noticed during last week's impeachment vote, again and again during that marathon session, was the rigidity of American political tribalism. The Democrats framed it all as a matter of principle. They invoked the Constitution, the oath of office, and the judgment of history. Republicans, of course, called BS on that. They said this is nothing more than a political vendetta. They said you guys have been out to overturn the election from day one. They called it an impeachment looking for a crime. It's you against us. Now, one of the truly strange things about this political moment is that some of the old ideological battle lines have actually softened since 2016. We rarely hear now about the national debt, for example, which was one of the great political divides for a generation or more. And yet the softening of those battle lines hasn't brought the parties together one inch. Somehow, exactly the opposite has happened. Today, our political correspondent, Charles Bethay, will be taking a long and close look at how partisanship is warping our politics. And if you think the floor of the House is the most partisan place in America, stick with us because Charles may surprise you. That's later this hour. We'll start, though, with the actor Peter Dinklage. For a long time, Dinklage considered himself a man of the theater, a downtown, off-Broadway kind of guy. And he had some good roles in small films, but then along came HBO's adaptation of Game of Thrones, and he was cast in the role of Tyrion Lannister.
Yes, Father, I'm guilty. Guilty? Is that what you want to hear?
You admit you poisoned the king?
No, of that I'm innocent. I'm guilty of a far more monstrous crime. I'm guilty of being a dwarf.
You are not on trial for being a dwarf.
Oh, yes, I am. I've been on trial for that my entire life.
Dinklage, who was 4.5 feet tall, gave Tyrion a towering presence, and he won 4 Emmys for his performance. But Game of Thrones ended this year, and Dinklage has gone back to his roots on stage.
I've done 12 shows in the past 8 days. I'm fried. Okay. Gotcha.
No problem.
Dinklage is the lead in a new adaptation of Cyrano, the classic play about a romantic who tries to win the woman he loves, despite his extraordinarily large and unattractive nose. Dinklage came in recently to talk with the staff writer Michael Shulman, and they spoke about how he connects with the character of Cyrano.
I never felt a connection with the nose of it all. As a person who looks like me, whenever I would watch a version of Cyrano, I would just think about, that's an actor and a fake nose. And we wanted to really strip it all down and get to the core of what it really is about, which is everybody's capacity to not feel worthy of love, whether you have a giant nose or not.
He is very, very beautiful.
Beautiful.
Yes. He is the most beautiful man I've ever seen.
I see. Have you spoken?
Never.
How do you know he loves you?
I know.
How can you love a man if you've never heard his voice?
I don't know, but I know that I do.
What if he's an idiot?
Then I will die.
It's really interesting how the show handles the nose part of Cyrano's story because, as you said, you don't wear a prosthetic nose, but other characters refer to his nose as like the
thing. We
refer
to it twice.
Right.
At the top.
Right, yeah. But in the audience, I guess we're left to sort of assume that they're talking in a maybe sideways way about your height or... Mm. Were you a part of the decision about that? I mean, how did you all discuss how you wanted to handle the nose aspect of it and how it would be presented.
Right. I mean, it does present sort of a puzzle because I'm not wearing a nose and I am the height I am. So people are going, you could feel it. They're a bit confused, but that's okay, I think. Let them follow you down the rabbit hole. But again, I don't think it has anything to do with my height either. I think Scott Stanglin, who is my understudy, he's 6 feet tall or something, and he can play the part probably as good or as better than I can.
Has he gone on?
No, not yet.
So we'll never know.
So it sort of has nothing to do with any of that, really. I was just cast because they wanted me for it, and I wanted to try something I've never done before.
Are you in love?
Why me? Yes, I dare.
With whom?
Oh, only the most intelligent, beautiful creature.
With whom?
With such a description, you have to ask.
Whom do you love?
Have you ever wanted something so badly you cannot breathe? Have you ever loved someone?
The adapter and director, Erica Schmidt.
Who I should say is your wife.
Years ago, got in touch with the band The National because their music is so romantic and filled with yearning and sometimes heartbreaking. And Matt's lyrics are so poetic, much like Cyrano's words, that it was such a natural fit, and they responded immediately, and they wrote these beautiful songs.
Many people probably have not seen you sing before, but you were in a punk band in the 90s.
Yeah.
Please tell me about your punk band.
We were punks, but we didn't play punk rock. A couple of friends from Columbia and a couple of friends from where I went to school in Bennington, Vermont. We got together and we just drank too much and played the old CBGBs, and we had a lot of fun. We had a following, but our following was kind of like progressive rock. It was all guys. What's the point of being in a rock band if there's no ladies, if you don't have any groupies? But I never intended to be in a band. It was just fun for me. And
the group was called Wizzy?
Wizzy, yeah.
Who came up with the name?
I think our drummer, Jim, did. But I felt I was being like a dilettante. I felt like they were all real musicians, and they still are. And I was just slumming it, being, you know, I don't know, just having fun. And I don't think that's fair.
What were some of your songs called?
I don't think it's... I think this New Yorker Radio Hour is too clean for
no,
some of the
not.
Song titles.
No, it's not.
Well, we had...
That makes me only want to know the song titles more.
Yeah. Well, one was called Dick of the Party, about being a loser drunk at a party. So I'll leave it there.
So speaking of your many talents, you now have your own production company. And one of the things that you have done is this HBO film, My Dinner with Hervé. And you play the French-born dwarf actor Hervé Villechaize, who is known for playing Nick Knack in the James Bond film The Man with the Golden Gun, and even more so for saying Duplaine on the 70s TV show Fantasy Island. So this project was 14 years in the making, is that right?
Yeah.
And so the writer-director of the film, Sacha Gervasi, had met Hervé years earlier as a journalist, and they had this crazy night out on the town in Los Angeles. And then what happened?
Well, Hervé killed himself a couple days after Sasha said goodbye to him. So Sasha realized it was sort of a suicide note, which is in true Hervé style. The man did nothing quietly. he was something else. And I got to know people in his life. He's so deeply loved, and he burned so brightly. So, you know, and it was just the first time I've ever played somebody who actually existed, mm-hmm. which was a real, really humbling, but also...
well, not only did he exist, but he was, I'm sure...
It's a complicated thing.
He was the actor with dwarfism who was most famous before you.
He wasn't really an actor, to be fair. Sorry, Hervé, I love you. He was an incredible painter.
Right.
But he just enjoyed the lifestyle of it all. we're sort of opposite in that way. I enjoy the lifestyle, but I don't go for the I don't know. I try to keep a lower profile, but I enjoy the work itself. Hervé really liked, he loved being the rock star that he was. So that's, he was guilty of that, and but no fault to him, because he was having a really good time and he was sort of unapologetic about it.
Right.
But he never really let his size define him. He wooed and he won many, many women, which I feel like, because of his size, was treated in the press like, wow, that guy, that, you know, it's just like, no, that wouldn't happen with anybody else who was regular size. It just was like a novelty that he was with women. Well, yeah, he was. Deal with it. Because he was charming.
So he was on TV when you were growing up in the 70s. What were your feelings about him and about, you know, representation in popular culture of dwarfism in general?
When you're 8 years old, social justice is not really entering into your biosphere there. I remember being a little bit aware that in Fantasy Island he was the sidekick, and you know, but nothing that really bothered me. But then adolescence sort of changes all that, your perspective on if you live in a unique shape, you become hyper aware of the world around you and how it reacts to you and how you engage with it. I'm not always the most politically correct person in terms of my dwarfism. I don't care, really. I think that can be damaging as well, and put up walls. Meaning, like, for example, if I see a kid and he's pointing at me and the parent has them, like, look the other way, what's that kid going to grow up into? Somebody that can't make eye contact with somebody who's 4.5 feet tall? That's sad to me. I understand it in the moment because they don't want to embarrass me. You know, what are we going to have, like an educational seminar walking down the street with a child? You know, there's no time for that. But those little things add up to, in our DNA, in terms of how we see people unique, physically unique, and that can be destructive. I'm not an actor to like change the world in terms of like how somebody my size is presented. Mm-hmm. I'm really not. I think, because that would be putting me before the work, and I'm attracted to roles that don't, it's just bad writing to make that the dominant character trait. Right. It's not my dominant character trait. It's part of, you know, it has to be part of a complex portrait that informs other pieces of your personality.
Mm-hmm.
But I just know when you read a script that they just want you because it's not going to happen. If they want you just to be because the suit fits or something, you know.
So I am going to have rocks thrown at me if I don't ask you about the finale of Game of Thrones. So I'm going to do it right now.
Who throws these rocks? The New Yorker is such a peaceful
people
magazine.
On this, people on this, on
the cartoonists?
Yeah, the cartoonists. Are gonna
they throw pictures
me.
Of rocks.
Did you follow the fan response?
No. I mean, you're never going to make anybody happy with anything we do. Everybody's going to always have an opinion, and that means an ownership. But that means they really loved it. It's like breaking up with somebody. They get upset. And I can't speak for everybody, but my feeling is they didn't want it to end, so a lot of people got angry. This happens. Monsters are created, and you don't see it coming. We vote them into office. You know, it happens. So for everybody to get upset because they loved a character so much and they had so much faith in that person, there were signposts all along the way
character. You're speaking, of course, of, spoiler alert, Daenerys.
Yeah.
Targaryen.
Yeah.
Took a bit of a fascist turn.
Yeah.
But
that's because, you know, what was happening all along, it added up to something. And, you know, I there are people who have named their children Khaleesi and gotten tattoos. You know, we're all tattoos on people, and you just gotta maybe wait till the season finale, the series finale, before you get that tattoo or name your golden retriever Daenerys. Like, you know, I mean, I can't help you. I'm sorry. I'm very sorry.
Did you expect that Tyrion would survive through to the end?
No, none of us did. None of us did. We were all nervous when we got the scripts, yeah.
Now that the show is done, you have a certain amount of cultural capital that you can really spend on doing things that you want. What do you want to do with it? You have a production company where you can make whatever, you know, whatever you're interested in.
Yeah.
You probably have any, you know, choice of roles.
Actors, they come in the ninth inning after a lot of creativity has been sparked, and I'm trying to rewind, and I'm producing now, that inspires me. That sort of being on something from the ground floor, creating something with a writer or director, and that's what I'm doing now. Acting, perhaps much more selectively than I've been doing, which I think that's just a natural progression of getting older, you know. Getting up at 5 a.m. in some strange location when you can be home in bed. It's that you really have to be a good project to get you there.
Since you get to rock out so much in Cyrano, is there any chance of getting Wizzy back together?
No, but I really want to make a cast album of Cyrano. That's a goal of mine. Never been on a cast album. So hopefully the band, The National, will consider that.
It's a real pleasure to talk to you. Thanks for coming in.
The actor Peter Dinklage, speaking with Michael Shulman, a staff writer at the magazine. You can read more from their interview at newyorker.com. You're listening to the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around.
On the next Radiolab, the story of a chimp who never got the chance to be a chimp.
It's called Lucy Growing Up Human.
She quickly learned to hold her own bottle. At 2 months, her eyes would focus.
A chimpanzee daughter in a psychotherapist's family.
At 3 months, she was trying to climb out of her crib to go to people. She was so responsive to being looked at.
Lucy from Radiolab. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Because this is the season, after all, we've got a story for you. A little story, a Christmas story. So here's Kathleen Turner in Children's Holiday Letters to Satan.
Dear Satan, what I really want this year more than anything is a Barbie dream house. It's pretty and pink, and I will keep it in my room near my bed. Merry Christmas, Allison, age 6.
Allison, huh, I see what you've done here. You intended for your letter to go to Santa, but due to your poor grasp of spelling, it has instead come to me. It really should go without saying, but I will not be getting you this so-called dream house because I do not want to. But I will suggest this. Buy it yourself. Simply take $2 from your mom's wallet every day, and soon enough, you'll have your useless and silly miniature house. Regards, Satan.
Dear Satan, I am Daniel, and I love you. I want an Xbox for Christmas. Daniel, age 9.
Dear Daniel, am I getting your name right? You only mentioned it twice in your 10-word letter. I've wasted 5 minutes of my life Googling this Xbox, and I suppose I'm left with one question. Why? This game, Grand Theft Auto, indeed seems quite fun, But why waste your days sitting in front of the TV when there are so many actual cars to be stolen? Damn it, Daniel! Get out there and live! Your friend, Satan.
Dear Satan, I just want my mom and dad to get back together. Stephanie, age 11.
Stephanie, you're over 10. Stop telling people your age. It's childish. As for your mommy and daddy, maybe it's my own shit, but it feels as if you're blaming me for their separation. While I did put Vicky from accounting in front of your father to tempt him, I didn't make up your father's unconvincing lie about working late. But I feel bad. I'm going to send you something called an Xbox. Best, Satan.
Dear Satan, I want a computer so I could do better in school and get a good job and make lots and lots of money. Thrum, David.
Dear David, being the embodiment of pure evil, I will not get you this computer. I'm not Mark Zuckerberg. Or am I? Kidding, I'm not. But if you really want a job that allows you to make a great deal of money fast, you can go ahead and send me your resume. I have a number of very close friends at Goldman Sachs. Regards, Satan.
Dear Satan, all I want for Christmas is world peace. Brian, age 4.
Dear Brian, no.
Children's Holiday Letters to Satan by Matt Passett from the New Yorker's Daily Shouts, and performed for us by the inimitable Kathleen Turner, along with the highly talented children of the New Yorker Radio Hour.
Implementation.
How dare you, Mr. Speaker?
The objection.
I'm David Remnick, and this...
The unseemly lack of leadership is incredible.
That's just another day in the state capital of North Carolina.
Childishness, cowardice. How dare you do this, Mr. Speaker?
A representative named Deb Butler is standing at her seat and shouting at Tim Moore, who's the Speaker of the House in the state legislature.
You are making a mockery of this process. You are deceiving all of North Carolina. Your leadership is an embarrassment.
The speaker had just called a vote to override a veto by the governor, which sounds like pretty standard business in a state capital, any state capital. So what's going on?
Are you proud of this? House Bill 5. Are you proud of yourselves? Look at you!
Passes chair direction.
There's no one here!
It's a story with a lot to tell us about the increasingly partisan nature of our country. And here's Charles Bethay, who's been covering politics for The New Yorker for more than a decade.
So most of my reporting for The New Yorker involves going to smaller communities, often in the Southeast, near Atlanta, where I live. I mean, you get a sense of the complexity of both the people and the issues in a way that you don't when you're looking at things like polls. You get texture, you get emotion, which makes things both more interesting and at times more inscrutable. This past summer and early fall, I started hearing more about how bad things were getting in North Carolina. And then I saw this video of this House legislative session, and it struck me as pretty wild.
Hey, this is Chris.
Chris, it's Charles Bethay. How are you?
Good, man. How are you?
I called up a guy I know named Chris Cooper. He's the head of the political science department at Western Carolina University. He's obsessive about North Carolina politics in a useful way.
So how would you just describe the partisan divide here? I guess, has it always been sort of rancorous and divisive and toxic?
Sure. I mean, I think North Carolina is a little bit of a bellwether. A couple of years before the rest of the country got nasty, I think we started to get nasty. I think part of the reason for that is that we had 100 years, essentially, of Democratic control in the state of North Carolina. So the Democrats controlled the General Assembly, which is what we call the state legislature here. But as the rest of the South changed partisanship, North Carolina did as well. But what we're left with today is a state that I would describe as a fairly moderate state, a purple state, a swing state, but a General Assembly that is overwhelmingly governed by the Republican Party. And at the same time now, you have a Democratic governor who barely, and I mean barely, won the governor's mansion this last round and is facing this majority Republican control.
So North Carolina is a purple state, which makes people think that there's going to be more, potentially more cooperation between the parties, that they're going to be closer on issues, but actually the opposite appears to be true. If we accept that North Carolina is a bellwether for the rest of the country, which it appears to be, it seemed important to figure out why it is the way it is. So in October, I went to Raleigh.
Mid-afternoon in Raleigh, walking over to meet the governor. It's hot outside. It's at 95 degrees, I think, which is apparently record-tying for this today, or maybe it's record-tying tomorrow. In either case, it does not feel like October. It's the new world we're in here.
The executive mansion feels a little like my grandmother's house. Musty, thick rugs, oil paintings, oak furniture. Also, according to an aide I talked to, it's haunted.
So I can't really get too into it, but it's haunted supposedly by Governor Fowle. So he was the first governor to live here, and he died in the executive mansion. So supposedly he likes to make sure things are A-OK. So
he's like a friendly ghost.
Yeah, most definitely. So
Governor Daniel Fowle was a Democrat. Even the ghosts in North Carolina are partisan. I met Governor Cooper in an office on the third floor that, oddly, had a rowing machine outside.
That's mine.
It is.
Yeah. My rowing has been curtailed when I had a herniated disc. So I got a text from Coach Mike Krzyzewski when I had my back operation saying that I needed to take it easy and not go back too fast because that's what happened to him. And I'm disappointed because I'm a UNC fan and I hadn't gotten my Roy Williams text yet.
I was about to say, we're going to talk about, speaking across the aisles. And if you're talking to Krzyzewski as a UNC guy, then that means you're able to do that effectively.
My campaign for governor of North Carolina brought UNC and Duke together.
So I want to start by talking about your election. So you beat Pat McCrory by about 10,000 votes. To what specific factors do you attribute your victory?
I don't think there's any question that the extreme right-wing legislation that he was rubber stamping, most people in North Carolina thought that was not the way to go. The bathroom bill that he had signed, the discriminatory voter suppression that has been passed, the shortchange.
So this struck me as kind of odd. Cooper's not talking about himself as a candidate. He's not outlining his vision for the state. He just goes right into attack mode. It was because of them, the other side. But maybe I shouldn't be surprised. He's been conditioned to talk like that. He's been under attack from North Carolina's Republicans since even before he took office. A few weeks before he was sworn in, the Republicans in the state legislature called a special session.
For what purpose does the gentleman from Harnett, Representative Lewis, rise?
To debate the bill.
The gentleman has the floor to debate the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
This is Republican Representative David Lewis. You'll want to remember that name.
The bill also does change the number of employees that are exempt from the State Personnel Act.
Lewis is arguing for a bill that would limit the number of appointments Cooper could make as governor. That bill passed. So did a bill giving the Republican-controlled Senate the power to confirm Cooper's cabinet appointments and a bill changing the makeup of the state board of elections to favor Republicans.
They went and began stripping the governor's office of power. So this was the first salvo.
Were you or were you not surprised by the power play right after you were elected?
I can't say that I was surprised, because this General Assembly and this Republican leadership had done everything it could to preserve its power, to curtail people's right to vote and draw districts that are technologically diabolical in the way they have gerrymandered them. To show you how diabolical it was, the head of the redistricting committee, he was being questioned about our congressional districts.
Vote totals for the two parties tend to be fairly close, and yet the voting maps had elected 10 Republican legislators and 3 Democrats. The head of the redistricting committee was asked how that could be.
His response, we couldn't figure out a way to make it 11-2.
That was David Lewis.
That was David Lewis. And
that won't be the last time you hear that name. Cooper's been clashing with the Republicans ever since on issues like redistricting, climate change, and most recently the state budget. In June, Cooper vetoed the budget put together by the Republicans in the General Assembly.
I vetoed the budget because it shortchanged education, because it denied health insurance for 500,000 to 600,000 North Carolinians when we could have easily taken Medicaid expansion.
In North Carolina, to override a veto, you don't need a 3/5 majority of all the members. You just need a 3/5 majority of the members who are there when the vote is called. So to make sure the Republicans couldn't overturn the veto, every Democrat had to show up at every House session.
But they have left their family obligations. One of them even left the sick bed of a spouse. One was going through chemotherapy for breast cancer. They came every single time that there was a potential for a vote. So what they continued to try to do was to coax Democrats to leave and to take walks and to create the right amount of people who were there in the chamber in order to override the veto. They could not do it. The only way they did it was lying to them. And that was a dark day in this state.
That day was September 11th.
Intentional, systemic deception.
Cooper told me it went down like this. The Republican chair of the House Rules Committee told the leader of the House Democrats that there wouldn't be any votes the morning of September 11th. So a bunch of Democrats took the morning off. By the way, want to guess who the Republican chair of the House Rules Committee is? It's David Lewis. You know what happened next.
I am objecting to they will not yield, Mr. Speaker.
I went into foxhole mode, I think. I just stood up and objected. You know, I was so scared, honestly.
That's Deb Butler, the Democrat from Wilmington.
I just used the best efforts I could muster, you know, and I tried to talk him down, and I tried to not yield the floor, and it was pandemonium, and the police were coming, and my colleagues surrounded me. I mean, it was chaos.
So what's life been like in the chamber since then? How have Republicans been treating you?
Very, very sweet to me in the days that followed. Offering me cookies, and Deb, can I carry that to you? And I was like, oh my gosh, really? Because there's a certain guilt that came with it. I know that they have to feel poorly about it. And now that vote, of course, sits in our Senate. It's still not law. We are operating without a budget to this day. And I know, for example, right now the Department of Transportation is struggling terribly. You know, we've had horrific flooding, and we have roads that are in dire need of repair because of these flood events. And they're struggling to have the equipment and the supplies that they need to be prepared. That will make holiday travel very difficult if we have a snow event or a heavy rain event. So,
I'm guessing there was a time in North Carolina when road repair wasn't a fiercely partisan issue, but that time appears to be over. So, according to the Democrats, the problem in North Carolina is the Republicans. I actually hear that a lot, and not just from elected officials, also from voters. People on one side pointing to the other and saying that that's where the problem starts. If I talk to a Republican, I'm sure he'd say the same thing about the Democrats. And the reason I'm sure of that is because I talked to a Republican, and that's what he said.
I think that it is plainly obvious that this is funded by money from the big left.
The Republican I talked to? Who else? David Lewis.
The New Yorker's Charles Bethay. His story about North Carolina politics and just how ugly it's gotten continues in a moment. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. North Carolina's state government might be one of the most fiercely partisan bodies in a country that is, I think we can all agree, ever more fiercely partisan. And in October, staff writer Charles Bethay went to Raleigh to try to figure out what exactly has gone wrong in North Carolina. The governor, who's a Democrat, gave Charles a simple and clear explanation. The Republicans did it. So Charles spoke with one of the state's most powerful Republicans, a man named David Lewis.
David Lewis has been in the North Carolina legislature for 16 years. He's a legislator through and through. He cares deeply about things like trash pickup and smoking regulations. And when the assembly isn't in session, he goes back home to his farm where he grows tobacco and cotton. He's known Governor Cooper for a long time.
Many of us had known Governor Cooper from the time he served in the General Assembly. We had known him certainly through his long tenure as Attorney General. I'd actually played basketball with the guy in the past. And every odd-numbered year, the North Carolina legislature plays the South Carolina legislature in a charity basketball game. That particular year, Attorney General Cooper and the Treasurer Richard Moore both played, and frankly, they were both better than I was.
That's big of you and generous of you to admit.
I had the size, but Roy had the speed and the skill.
That's the last nice thing you're going to hear David Lewis say about Roy Cooper.
Governor Cooper made the strategic decision to bring in a host of advisors who I think are very much to the left of mainstream North Carolina politics, sort of the old moderate Democrat that Roy Cooper had portrayed. That person went away and was replaced with a much more aggressive leftist-oriented political figure.
David Lewis is no moderate himself. He's probably best known for this statement that he made during a hearing on gerrymandering in 2016.
I propose that we draw the maps to give a partisan advantage to 10 Republicans and 3 Democrats because I do not believe it's possible to draw a map with 11 Republicans and 2 Democrats.
In general, it's not a good thing to pull a single sentence out of context like that. So can you briefly give us a little bit about why you made that statement?
That statement was made after a multiple-day process in which we were tasked with redrawing districts, which normally takes 6 months. We were given 2 weeks. I had made clear in previous statements that there were multiple criteria that were being followed in drawing the districts.
When he says criteria, he means things like trying to make districts have similar populations or trying to avoid dividing up counties.
If politics had been the only criteria, I could have probably found a way to have given Republicans a chance to win 12 out of the 13 seats.
So the maps may have been biased towards Republicans, but they weren't as biased as David Lewis could have made them. Yeah, in a weird way, it's kind of refreshing to hear David Lewis cop to that. If you think of politics as something kind of pure and pristine, what David Lewis said would sound shocking. But I don't view politics that way. I haven't for some time. I don't think David Lewis does either, and he certainly doesn't think the Democrats do.
there is a national movement that I think is led largely by former Attorney General Eric Holder. I think that it is plainly obvious that this is funded by money from the big left. I know that George Soros held a fundraiser for this event on October 21st at his home. I find it extremely dubious that people who claim to be for fair maps are funded by a group whose IRS filings say that their goal is to get more Democrats elected.
Would you rather voter maps be quote-unquote fair or help elect Republicans?
I think that voter maps should definitely be fair. I struggle with anybody who will define for me what fair means. The only thing that I believe the people that are suing us thinks is fair is some kind of map that gives the Democrats the majority.
I don't think Lewis just disagrees with the Democrats on the issues. To me, it sounds like he's got a grudge against the Democrats. I called Chris Cooper, the political science expert, and he said that when it comes to North Carolina politics, some level of grievance is kind of justified. The Democrats ran the North Carolina legislature for about 100 years, and when they were in charge, they didn't exactly play fair.
In the 1990s, the gerrymandering was called political pornography by the Wall Street Journal. And at that point, that was the Democrats doing the gerrymandering. In the early 2000s, there was a guy named Jim Black, who was Democratic Speaker of North Carolina. And the Republicans took the House by two seats. So to combat that, he actually met a guy in an IHOP bathroom, you can't make this stuff up, and offered him $50,000 and a job for his son if he would be willing to convert from the Republican to the Democratic Party. He did that, and so we ended up with a co-speaker arrangement in North Carolina for a little while.
The year that Jim Black bribed that Republican legislator was also the year David Lewis was elected to the General Assembly.
So if it feels like the Republicans had this sort of pent-up frustration, it's probably because they did, and it was probably well-deserved.
Even when Lewis talks about the veto override vote, that sort of shady move the Republicans pulled while the Democrats weren't there, he sees it as an example of Democratic shadiness.
I am disappointed that many of my House colleagues who are Democrats have not been in this institution long enough to understand that they are not employees of or under the direction of the governor. They work for their folks back home. I think the governor has put many of my Democratic colleagues into very bad positions. That being said, I do wish that the circumstances were a little bit clearer about where the Democrats were at that time. The minority leader has said that he knew that 52 of their 55 members were present in the building at the time. So why they weren't on the floor is a truly baffling thing to me.
The House Minority Leader Darren Jackson told us that's totally false. He says his members rushed to the legislative building when they heard what had happened, but that was after the whole thing went down. Do you have friends in the Democratic caucus? Close friends or?
I do.
And what? So tell me about that. What are those relationships like, given the strain put on the professional side of things?
It's been very difficult. I believe that I have probably lost a friend who I would have considered among my closest friends. And I am deeply saddened by that. But I think this comes down to the folks who work for Governor Cooper are doing everything they can to keep the legislative Democrats in line behind him. Unfortunately, many have chosen to go that route and abandon long-held relationships here in this building and, more importantly, to this institution.
I went to Raleigh to try to understand North Carolina politics, because it is a bellwether. After the power grab vote following the governor's election, there were similar power grabs in Wisconsin and Michigan. Understanding how this kind of partisanship grows up That's important to do. There was one other guy I wanted to talk to while I was in Raleigh, somebody I've known a long time. When I was a kid, I went to this outdoorsy Christian summer camp in Western North Carolina. It was run by a guy named Chuck McGrady. My brother was a counselor at the camp, and one summer, Chuck busted him smoking a joint. Chuck's not in the summer camp game anymore, though. These days, he's a member of the North Carolina House of Representatives.
Chuck, yeah, Chuck McGrady, right here. Chuck.
Yes.
Hey.
Hello there.
Good to see you.
Good to be seen.
How are you?
Oh, pretty good.
Good. Chuck's got a big portrait of a rhino hanging on the wall of his office. That's a pun. Chuck's often called a rhino. That's R-I-N-O, Republican in name only. You won't find many politicians with Chuck's resume.
Well, but I'm an anomaly again, you know. And I first ran Sierra Club president running as a Republican. You've got to be kidding me. I've always sort of worked in that fringe. When I was with Sierra Club, I was on the right fringe. I was one of the few guys that could talk to Republicans. I sounded like a Republican. I sit sort of in the middle of the political spectrum, which there's not a lot of that these days.
Is it a lonely place here?
It can be, but also when we actually want to take action on some range of things, it's amazing how many times people end up on that couch, including speakers, asking me to help bring together a coalition somewhere in the middle.
This level of partisanship that was it's often described as toxic now, if you agree with that or something like that, where did it begin?
Well, I don't know where it began, but I mean, and I think there's some toxicity to it prior to my getting here, because everybody's always pointing to backward to, you know, what the Democrats did when they're in charge and now the Republicans are. But, you know, two bad things don't correct it.
Or to put it another way, two wrongs don't make a right. I want to stop there. So I went to North Carolina thinking this might be a story about Trump's anger and Twitter rancor trickling down to politicians at the state level. But actually, what I saw was years and years of animosity and resentment and grievance and how they're actually bubbling up into the politics. In a way, that grievance and resentment, it's the same fuel that powers the Trump machine. Trump himself was elected because of grievance. It's tempting when we look at North Carolina or other states to think about their politics in intellectual or ideological terms, and that's important, but it misses out on the people who are in politics and the way they feel about each other and communicate with each other and whether they trust each other. The politicians I talked to have gotten themselves so wrapped up in getting back at each other, so they're stuck. You can't continually pile up wrong after wrong and expect to get anywhere. And that's what Chuck McGrady is talking about here. His advice might be cliche, but it's dead on. Two wrongs don't make a right. That's some wisdom only an old camp director could drop on you.
Well, you know, my advice to my leadership was to take a little time off, you know.
Cool off.
Yep. Time out. Again, you know, back in summer camp, I could do that. I could put the boy on the front porch and say, you know, you just sit there and think about what you just did. You know, we'd be better off if we sent everybody to summer camp and they learned how to work with each other. And it's the same behavior sometimes.
Chuck McGrady, a Republican member of the North Carolina General Assembly, and he spoke with The New Yorker's Charles Bethay, a staff writer based in Atlanta. That's it for today. Thanks for joining us. And remember, on Christmas Day, the movie Little Women opens. And if you missed my interview with Greta Gerwig, who wrote and directed the film, you can find it on the podcast of The New Yorker Radio Hour. Have a terrific holiday, and if you're traveling, be safe. Please join us next time for The New Yorker Radio Hour.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Karen Frillman, Kala Leah, David Krasnow, Caroline Lester, Louis Mitchell, Michelle Moses, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Morgan Flannery, Allison McAdam, Meng-Fei Chen, and Emily Mann. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.